defense journalist now to a defense commentator. Our guest today is one of South Asia's most respected voices on strategic affairs and national security. Nitin Gokhale, welcome to India, Russia and the World.
Thank you very much.
You've covered wars and conflicts for decades. Have you ever seen a situation so unpredictable, so complex, frankly, so bizarre as what's happening in the West Asian region today?
Conflicts are always complex, but this one, because we're seeing it in real time, given the kind of coverage that is happening and otherwise, we also have a chief executive of a big country like the United States or the president who is more bizarre than anyone else I've seen in my own experience, which makes it not just interesting, but complex as well as complicated for anyone who wants to report, who wants to analyze, because it's fast moving. And the number of players involved in this, in a sense, Iran, Israel, the Gulf countries, China and Russia sort of in the background. And the effect it is having on the world, the second and the third order effects on the rest of the world. Iran is actually giving complex problems to solve for everyone.
Especially to the global south.
To the global south, because of the nature of the energy supplies and the geography that Iran controls or where it's situated. It is creating problems from for countries from Japan to maybe even right down to Maldives, not to speak of India, which is the biggest, I would say, problem which India is facing in the past 20 years or so.
There's also a parallel war playing out on social media. On one hand, you have Donald Trump making unpredictable statements, using F-words. And then on the other hand, we've got Iran that's using AI and memes to counter that. It's almost like a geopolitical roast battle happening on social media, isn't it?
It is. Social media is now the battlefield. Actually, I always say now for the past 10 years or so that social media battles begin before kinetic wars just come to our doorsteps. Because this is where minds are shaped, opinions are formed, and then you sort of start looking at issues from different angles. And that's exactly what Iran has managed to do to put down President Trump through the memes and the AI-generated graphics and videos.
But do you think then it is Iran that is winning the social media war?
It is, because it is mocking the President of the United States, the most powerful country in the world. And President Trump himself comes out as a caricature of a president because of his own statements and unhinged kind of utterances and rants that he has. And because of his constantly shifting position, nobody wants to take him seriously. And that's the problem for US today. Its credibility has been dented, maybe even completely destroyed by President Trump himself.
And do you not think that it's a very strange kind of situation? Because on one hand, you don't want to believe what he's saying. And on the other hand, he is the president of the United States of America. And you do have to pay attention to what he's saying.
Well, you have to pay attention, all right. But how long will you pay attention to one statement? And when would the next statement come? Nobody knows. And therefore, everybody is wary. Everybody is playing it by the ear.
From a real military standpoint, how strong is Iran today?
Well, a lot of its capacity and capability has been degraded, but it still remains standing and firm because it's got its own military industrial complex, indigenously developed technology, and a surge capacity for manufacturing. And therefore, its missiles, its air defense systems, it's what they call the mosaic defense strategy that it has adopted. And the way it has taken advantage of its geography gives Iran still the staying power and the resilience which no one expected them to have. And I think that's where the US and Israel both underestimated Iran's strength and resilience.
Iran opened the Strait of Hormuz last week, but then Donald Trump, he didn't budge and he continued with the US naval blockade. Iran since closed the Strait of Hormuz again. Does the onus now of whether or not this suffocating choke point will open lie with the US?
It has to say that, okay, if Iran is opening it, then we will allow ships to go through. But Donald Trump is taking a maximalist position, thinking that Iran will either succumb or budge from its position, which it doesn't seem to be doing because it knows that this is the advantage it has. And all other countries will then put pressure on the United States to try and modify its stance. So far, it hasn't happened. But Iran is sticking to its stand right now that unless the US lifts the blockade, we are not going to allow other ships to come in. And I think everyone knows that without their permission, no ships can transit through Strait of Hormuz.
It might sound a bit odd, but is Iran's grip on the Strait of Hormuz actually its trump card?
It is one of the advantages it has. Like I said, the geography is in its favor. And therefore, Iran is taking full advantage of sitting astride or controlling Strait of Hormuz, which any country with its back to the wall will take. And therefore, I'm not surprised that not just its military, its technology, its military industrial capability, but taking advantage of geography, Iran has been able to withstand this enormous pressure that has been brought to bear on them by Israel and US.
We also saw two Indian flag tankers that were fired upon by the IRGC. This was despite having a prior clearance. What does this indicate or say tell about the actual operational control of the strait?
Iran is not a monolithic state. It's got several power centers. It's got the military, it's got the IRGC, it's got the political and the theological leadership, all that. So sometimes I think there are problems of communication. And probably Iran's IRGC Navy, which controls right now the passage through Strait of Hormuz, was not very keen that any ship goes because of the US blockade. It wanted to give some signal there to everybody. And it's just that Indian ships got caught in that confusion and that competition.
For India, how serious is the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and how long can India really cope with this closure?
Well, I don't know how long it can cope. Of course, it has reserves of crude and energies that it has, what is it called, the strategic reserves. But LPG is a problem because LPG production has halted in Qatar. The gas production in these countries in West Asia has halted. And therefore, alternative sources are hard to come by. And one has to brace for some kind of an impact. There is no denying the fact that India is the hardest hit. So let's be very frank and honest about this, that there's going to be hard times for Indian consumers and Indian common people.
Are we staring at a world recession?
Recession, I doubt whether a recession will happen because Donald Trump's foremost interest is also stock markets. And if you see his utterances, they're all timed according to the opening of the market and the closing of the market from Monday and Friday are the two days when he makes those bizarre statements, which are completely illogical. But from his own perspective, to make money, insider trading, as they call it, that's happening with his family and friends. And that's a major charge one can sort of level against President of the US, that he's interested in making money more than, sort of doing anything about the geopolitical issue of Iran. And I think that's the pattern is very evident.
But then you're saying that Donald Trump's statements are not as unpredictable as people are assuming them to be. He's very calculated.
They're not unpredictable, but they're unhinged. And I mean, his own whole use of language and, trying to browbeat people through statements and a state like Iran is what is sort of not just unpredictable, but also unacceptable, really. But yes, there is a method to madness.
Donald Trump is also called NATO cowardly. Do you think that the Iran war has shattered the myth of the Western alliance unity.
Well, yes, it has irrevocably now told us that the transatlantic friendship or alliance is broken. Whether it can be fixed or not, only time will tell. But this indication was there for the Europeans right from Donald Trump's first term as president. He has been telling them, he has been lecturing them that you have outsourced your security to US and you are making your own money. You are not spending enough money of your own. You up your budgets, defense budgets. I am not going to pay for your security because you don't give us anything. He has been saying this from his first term. So the Europeans should have woken up earlier.
The first round of talks between the US and Iran that happened in Islamabad. Now the second round of talks is in limbo. Which side do you think appears to be more desperate at the moment?
At the moment, I think the US appears desperate. It wants out. It wants an off-ramp from Iran because Trump has realized that he's not winning the war. And of course, Iran can't agree to all the humiliating terms that he wants to impose of giving away uranium, enriched uranium, not doing anything for 20 years. All that Iran will not accept because the regime will then fall. And therefore, I think Iran appears to be a stronger side in the negotiations. But again, they'll have to decide how long can they hold on. Iran will have to decide. And Trump's patience, if it runs out, what happens? Then is it catastrophe? Is it the bombing going to start again?
I mean, he's already warned of wiping off the whole civilization.
Yes, entire civilization. But that is again unhinged. Now, with Iran's pushback and the resilience Iran has shown, the US will be questioned. I mean, US's power will be questioned. That does it all this big military that one has built, is it good enough? You can't, they have not been able to invade the country. There is wariness about sending boots on the ground, given what happened in Afghanistan, what happened in Iraq. So therefore, US is now seen as a power that can be taken on. The Taliban has shown it. I mean, Iran has only reinforced it.
Islamabad has positioned itself as a mediator, as a messenger in the US-Iran talks. Do you think, Nitin, that this is a setback for New Delhi?
Well, don't look at it from this lens. Let's look at Pakistan alone and its history. For 60 years or 70 years, Pakistan has always been a useful medium for great powers in various ways. In 1971, it allowed the most consequential reset of ties between two big powers, US and China. It allowed itself to be used and as a result got a benefit from both the countries that they did. They've done something similar with...
But is that a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing, but see, so let's look at two states, India and Pakistan. India is confident, India is wealthier than Pakistan. It doesn't need patronage. Pakistan always needs patronage for itself. I will not go to the extent of saying that it is a broker. I would say that it is a country which has perfected the art of making the impossible into possible as far as countries are concerned. And it punches above its weight. Yes, agreed. But India doesn't have to do it. Pakistan needs to compulsorily do this for its survival. Americans have had a love-hate relationship with the Pakistani military and the elite. And they use them when required, throw them when not required. India, on the other hand, doesn't need all this because it's a self-confident country. It's got its own strengths. It's got its own, a population which can do whatever it wants. It can survive on its own. Pakistan cannot survive on its own. It constantly needs, being fed by the Saudis sometimes by the Americans, sometimes by the Chinese, or all together at times. Therefore, there's a difference. So, it's not a setback. I won't see this as a setback at all because India's never, in its history, independent India's history, been a mediator or the other word is broker for peace between any countries.
While Islamabad, of course, is seen as the face of brokering peace between Iran and the US, there are also murmurs that China is doing a bit of backseat driving here. Do we know anything?
There is a possibility, certainly. Don't forget, Pakistan's all-weather friend is China. And I don't rule out the fact that China is giving advice to Pakistan. China is also friends with Iran. Let's not forget that. So it must be playing a part. But we haven't seen any public evidence that China is involved there. China, I'm sure, is speaking to all players because it is a power. It is the number two power in the world. There's no doubt about that.
New Delhi and Moscow, they appear to have slightly different foreign policy approaches when it comes to the Iran war. Could that create friction between the two countries?
The relationship between Moscow and New Delhi is independent of their relationship with third countries. That said, one can always point fingers at India's decision to appear not to take a side or not to remain neutral in the Israel-Iran war by, the signals that were sent when Prime Minister went to Tel Aviv just days before the war broke out. But, you look at it the other way. Iran and India have always had good relations. And for years, India has balanced its ties with Iran on one hand and Saudi Arabia on the other, when they were actually mortal enemies. India has done the same thing with Palestine and Israel when they were at loggerheads. But Russia and India, I don't think, will have any divergence or any problem in relationship between the two. They might have differences about how they deal with Iran, each other individually, but not about their relationship.
How important, how crucial is Russian oil today in the global market? And I ask this question also with the perspective of Trump's approach. One day there's a sanction on Russian oil, then there's a waiver, then the sanction again, and then the waiver again.
So he's torn between the fact that does he prevent Russia from making money by sanctioning the oil and not allowing India to buy the oil, and then getting the crude oil prices in the bracket or in the range where it is affordable for everyone. I think right now is torn between that. Today is decided in the last 2 months, or has allowed it till what, May, mid-May, the waiver to India. Because if India buys more Russian oil, the prices remain stable in the international market. Temporarily has allowed this. How it will pan out, one doesn't know. But India will have to take a call on how it deals with this kind of a situation.
Does this reflect an imperialistic mindset? Washington deciding who buys oil from whom and under what terms?
Well, it does, of course. If you look at what Rubio said at the Munich Security Conference about the Europeans and the Americans' whites to get together and to have the old policies of controlling the world. Imperialism is very much embedded in the American thought, and it is just now being expressed more openly than before.
This year is also India's BRICS presidency. Do you think that it's a real opportunity for New Delhi to assert itself, given the fact that the US dominance is somewhat shaky and the NATO alliance has clearly broken?
Indeed, in fact, India should use this as an opportunity to assert itself. Whether it will do or not, I can't really predict, because there are many angles to this whole geopolitics that is happening right now of the groupings. The US doesn't want BRICS to become powerful. US doesn't want BRICS to become an alternative power center. And yet, the new members of the BRICS, UAE and others, and Iran, they're all demanding that BRICS condemn the US and Israeli aggression. Now, it's going to be a great balancing act for India, because India is also friends with Israel and US. And of course, Russia on the other hand, and China is an adversary again. So it's a very complicated alphabet soup that India is in.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, he is expected to come to India again for the BRICS summit sometime in September. This is going to be his second visit in less than a year. Does this signal how important New Delhi has become for Moscow?
I think they're important for each other. I think the friendship between Prime Minister Modi and President Putin is well known. Personal warmth that they have. And the way India has supported Russia at least not gone against Russia, not condemned it from February 2022, when the world was expecting India to do that.
And putting pressure.
Everyone was putting pressure on India, the Europeans, the Americans, everyone was putting pressure. But India didn't succumb to that pressure, or didn't budge from its position, saying that it's not an era of war, all right, but we are not going to condemn Russia for what it has done in Europe or against Ukraine, because that's their decision. We are nobody to interfere. And that's been India's policy for a long time. And that shows that India and Russia ties are robust, they are dependable, and they are going to be only going up north rather than going south.
Could the growing Russia-Iran military cooperation change the balance of power in West Asia?
It's very clear that today Iran has emerged as the most powerful nation in West Asia, because it has shown that Russian and Chinese help, whether overt or covert, and its own technology and ability to manufacture, surge manufacturing in defense, Iran has emerged, and Russia has helped Iran to emerge as one of the most powerful countries in West Asia. And therefore, the equations in West Asia are going to change.
Moscow and Beijing have been Iran's true support. But then do you think that much of the Muslim world let down Iran?
Oh, well, Muslim world was thinking that Iran should not emerge as a superpower in West Asia. And therefore, they were expecting U.S. help to maintain the strategic balance in the region. Iran prides itself as a very old civilizational state, which is, which has got traditions and it's got history on its side. And these are all new states. The Arab states in the Iranian eyes are neo-rich kids on the block. And therefore, they don't treat them as equals. And therefore, the Muslim world has never been united, really. If they were united, we wouldn't have 40 Muslim states or 60 Muslim states in the world. There would be one Muslim state, right? So therefore, I'm not surprised that there are these rivalries. There is a Saudi-UAE rivalry. There is a UAE-Yemen rivalry. You know, this myth of Muslim unity, or that Muslim world is now got divided, is just a myth.
Let's talk about what the US and Iran gained out of the war, what the US and Iran lost in the war.
So US lost credibility. Iran lost much of its military prowess and the top leadership. But when you say about the gains, Iran has gained more credibility, bigger standing, and it'll emerge as one of the superpowers in West Asia, which I don't think Israel or US wanted that to happen. So they have gained that. US, I don't know whether there are any gains which are tangible at the moment. So I would refrain from saying that there are any gains for the US at the moment.
Since the war started, the Strait of Hormuz, which was open before the war, is now closed. The uranium stockpiles, they're very much still with the Iranians. The Khamenei has been replaced with another Khamenei.
When you start a war without an end objective in mind, which is what the US did, this is what the result is. Every war has a political objective. And if the political objective was the collapse of the Iranian regime, it hasn't happened. So anything that US gains out of the negotiations now would be a face saver. It's the off-ramp that it is looking for.
My last question, and I'll ask this very simplistically. When countries see a particular country, which is perceived as the most powerful country in the world, start a mindless war, does that give them, well, some sort of a window to start their own little war?
Well, it can. They can be tempted to follow that model. But you see, there's a difference between what US can bring to the table in terms of unending supplies of ammunition and platforms and firepower. Can other countries say the same thing, and can they sustain it? Is it good for their economy? Is the question that they'll ask themselves. And may not start. See, we think of wars as irrational outcomes. But wars many a times are fought as I said, with political objectives. Not many a time, most of the times. And therefore, anybody who wants to start a war will think about it. It can't be a irrational or a instantaneous or a spontaneous decision. And I don't think countries will take that temptation. In fact, it's easy to start a war, but to end it on your own terms and your own timing is the most difficult one. They say initiating a conflict is the easiest part. Terminating the conflict is the hardest part.
So, do you think it's going to be time that'll tell us when this war ends?
Yes, I think the negotiations are already on. That means there is a movement towards stopping the war. And I'm sure and I hope that it'll end sooner than later, because for everybody's good, for India's good, for the world's good.
On that note, thank you very much, Nitin Gokhale, for joining us.
My pleasure.